down and introduce our first guest speaker tonight, Jeff News. Hey! Yes.
13 August 2008.
So I guess my first question is to ask Jeff, how far do you want me to go over?
I don't know. I usually go at least half an
hour. Okay, I'll try and keep it under 2 hours. So we're going to talk a little bit about running Linux on Linksys routers. A couple of different versions we're going to talk about. Two major ones are OpenWRT and DDWRT. We'll see examples of both of them. So the first question is, why? Why would you want to do this? Some people like command line. You can get more functionality. There are packages to run things like Asterisk on Linksys routers, Hotspot software,
Asterisk
things like...
on a Linksys router?
Yep.
How you can hook up the hardware?
The software's there. I've never done it. I couldn't tell you how it works, but it's doable. You can set your router up as a hotspot, do a captive portal kind of thing, force user authentication or agreement of terms of service before allowing them access. You want to put an SMB client on your router, maybe mount a Samba Share someplace, you can do that. Wireless IDS, you can string a bunch of these things together, set them all up as Kismet drones, and then monitor all the wireless traffic in the area that they can see. So all sorts of cool things you can do. Sometimes you just want a better GUI, or a different GUI than what the vendor supplied. And it adds to your geek cred. So how we got here is that Linksys originally had their firmware running on an embedded version of Linux. So the GPL said, hey, you got to publish your source. So Linksys did, and immediately people started to go into town on it. A number of different hacks came up for Linux on Linksys. Some of you may have read that the Linksys routers, as they ship, do not run Linux anymore. They are actually running something called VxWorks, which is from Wind River Systems. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I do know Wind River is real heavy into BSD. I'm not quite sure if they're doing something, and if they're using a BSD licensed software, that would explain why they're able to keep it closed. The other thing is that the newer versions that do not run Linux by on their native firmware are a little bit crippled, shall we say. They don't have as much RAM. They don't have as much flash. There's not as much you can do with them because they don't have quite the heft that they need
to. Do you
know
how to spot the difference?
Yes.
Visually.
Well, visually, no, I don't. But if you've got a serial number in front of you, you can go to Wikipedia, and they've got a whole page on Linksys WRT routers and variants, and they will match up serial number ranges with the hardware that's inside. It is getting harder and harder to find the older Linksys models that have the more resources. In fact, it's getting harder to find even the G model and the WRT54Gs of any flavor. You're seeing more Ns. Having said that, there are a couple of different models that are maybe a little bit better to go with. There is a WRTG54L, which the L means Linux. It's going to cost you about $15-$20 more than the ordinary garden variety Linksys. That will get you a usable amount of flash and RAM. Don't get me wrong, on the newer, lower-end ones, you can still run a Linux distribution, but you're probably going to be command-line only. There's going to be some applications that just plain won't work. So stay away from those if you can. It's also worth mentioning that not every... that you can run your Linux distribution on something other than a Linksys. Netgear just came out with a open-source... wireless router a few months ago. It's got a decent hardware capability behind it. I think it's 16 meg of flash. And Asus actually makes one that's got 32. And that's one that I would seriously look at if I were going to buy myself a new router. Because not only does it have that extra flash, it's got more RAM, and it's got two USB ports. That is a Asus 500 something. It's maybe 80, 90 bucks on Newegg.
Hey, NAS device.
Mm-hmm.
And a 500 gig drive on it.
Yeah. So, we've kind of covered some of this already, what hardware you need. Okay, so one of the earliest distributions that was intended for a wireless router was from a company by the name of Svisoft. I think I'm mangling that. However, they've kind of run afoul of the GPL, or at least people are claiming they've run afoul of the GPL. Although they were one of the original redistributors of and modifiers of the Linksys firmware, they actually are alleged to have taken GPL binaries from the OpenWRT project, included it in their product, and did not ever release source. So live off the GPL and then violate it. You don't see too much about them anymore. Then there is DDWRT, which is pure GPL. It is actually a modification of the old Svisoft modifications of the Linksys firmware. And actually, if you look at the interface to DDWRT, which we'll see a little bit later on, it looks a whole lot like the Linksys interface. And then OpenWRT is completely from scratch. That is also pure GPL. And then there's another thing called Tomato, which I'm just going to mention in passing. It includes some proprietary Broadcom code. It's got a proprietary web interface, which is supposed to be kind of cool. It's very Ajax-y, but you don't see too much about it. So how do you decide what firmware to use? Read the feature list. Figure out what it is you want to do and make sure that your firmware supports it. Figure out that your router can support it. And this is actually the harder part. Each of these distributions has many multiple images, and it's fairly tailored to what to specific models and to specific amounts of RAM and flash. And you want to make sure that you really go through carefully and read what your requirements are for a given image, because otherwise there is a chance that your firmware upgrade will fail. Actually, flashing the router with new firmware is really easy. If you've still got the original Linksys firmware, there is actually an upgrade firmware button in the GUI. So you just download your new image, and then you go to the Linksys web interface, click upgrade firmware, off you go. It is literally as simple as that. Other options, you may be able to use TFTP to upload your firmware, which actually is not a whole lot different than upgrading the firmware on a Cisco router. Actually, come to think of it, Linksys is Cisco now.
What happens if it blows up?
We'll get there. And DDWRT, at least, has a command line utility for upgrading your firmware. Generally, you want to do this over a wired connection. Doing this over wireless is a little bit risky. It's also worth noting that before you find out the hard way and panic, the firmware will reset your router's IP address. So whatever you connected to, if it's not 192.168.1.1, it is going to be after your router reboots. So you will need to make sure that you have something on a 192.168.1 network that can connect to it. And also not having another 1.1 someplace else on the network. Always fun when that's your gateway. And don't interrupt the upload. Do not touch the system. Don't breathe on it. Go into the other room and make coffee or something.
For how long?
It's usually only a couple of minutes. And actually, the firmware, whatever firmware it is, will give you a nice little screen saying, rebooting, please wait. So once you do your upload, it should give you some feedback as to what's going on.
Okay.
In this process, you're using some kind of loose term, completely replace the firmware on the box,
right?
There's no other BIOS or anything else in here?
No, there is no such thing as a BIOS. What there is NVRAM, non-volatile RAM, which actually stores configurations, even if the router is powered down. And that is where a lot of your configuration is going to be done. When you're sitting at the command line on DDWRT or OpenWRT, or you're making changes in the web interface, you're actually changing settings in NVRAM more likely than not. This is what you wanted to know, right? Kind of depends on what you did, how badly you blew it up, and what kind of hardware you got. Sort of like everything else, what model you have is going to affect how you recover. In general, the reset button is your friend. If you've got a bad flash, if you hold the reset button, unplug it, and then plug it in again, and then finally release the reset button, there's a good chance that'll work. Now, you may have to wait 30 seconds between unplugging it and plugging it in again, so you may end up with your finger on that reset button for a minute and a half. But that can help you recover from a bad flash. Also, bear in mind that once you flash, you are not going to restore the earlier firmware version. This isn't going to get you back to the vendor-supplied firmware.
Is there any way to suck out the previous version?
Suck out?
Oh, we back it up.
Oh, yeah. There's actually a screenshot of that in one of the GUIs that we'll see a little bit later on. Okay, a thing called boot_wait. Boot wait is very important. Don't ever, 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 ever turn it off. I mean, never. Absolutely. Because what boot wait does is it gives you about a 5-second pause between when your router powers on and when it actually starts its boot process. This gives you a 5-second window when you can try and TFTP up another firmware image. So if you've got boot wait enabled, all else fails, you still might be able to get a new firmware on there. And then there is a wiki page, ddwrt.org, which really has a lot of information about recovering from bad flashes, a lot more than I can... Did I just say bad flashes in the presentation? Anyway. So this is what you get when you first install the OpenWRT. It's kind of a sparse, bare-bones interface. They give you the nice little OpenWRT logo, ASCII art, with a recipe for making a white Russian.
So while you're waiting for the firmware to load...
Yes, go make yourself a white Russian. Uh-huh.
Now, is that a web interface?
That is a web interface, yeah. This is all browser-based.
You can cut the browser off.
Yeah. Actually, all these OpenWRT screenshots, these are right from xwrt.org, which has their own web interface, which we'll talk about in a moment. They were nice enough to put all their wiki entries under GPL. Most of the embedded Linux firmwares for these routers are going to run 2.4 kernel. There's not too many of them that are doing a 2.6. I'm not quite sure of the reasoning behind that, but that's pretty much what it is.
It might be size. 2.6 is still bigger.
Yeah, that very well could be. And then you've got some system settings here, host name, boot weight, and a little drop down enabled, and get a language. You can see they've got some just a generic password change, installed software, firmware upgrade. That's where you do that through web interface. Got some network setting pages. This LAN configuration, your IP address, and your netmask and DNS servers. This is a command prompt, and this has actually got a couple of different interesting things on here. What we are doing is, besides looking at the same banner is in the web interface, let's see if we can blow this up a little bit. Or not. Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Yeah, thanks.
Can you guide the cord up just a little bit?
Yeah.
Feeling better back there, guys? Sorry about the keystone.
But anyway, the first thing that you're going to see when you log into this thing over a command line is that you are using BusyBox as your shell. Very light, stripped-down shell that you'll see in a lot of rescue disks. Question?
No. Oh,
okay. And then what they're doing here is they're doing iPackage. iPackage is a packaging system for embedded Linux systems that works a whole lot like apt-get. Instead of apt-get install, you do an iPackage install. So what they're doing here is they are installing from this website, the WebIF web interface package, which will install the upgraded web interface, which we're going to see for the rest of the OpenWRT slides. So installing to root, configuring, figures out, yes, we're running on a WRT 54G, GS, or GL. Does a couple of firmware things, says success. And then says you may need to do a refresh to clear the old stuff out of your browser. Pretty straightforward. The only thing about iPackage, you cannot do a complete system update with iPackage. You can't do like an iPackage disk upgrade. But what do you expect from your 4 mega? So this is the new interface. It's a little bit nicer looking. It has a few more features to it, giving you some system information, gives you your MAC address. This one, they actually used that ASUS. It's got the USB ports and the extra flash. Web management console, WebIF2, the version number.
Broadcom board. I thought Broadcom wasn't GPL.
I am not completely sure how this works. Everybody, I'm sure, here knows all the pain and suffering that went with Broadcom and NDIS wrapper. So I don't know how the Broadcom chips and the wireless or in the Linksys routers work without having any of that same pain and suffering, unless it's because that was all part of what got released by Linksys under the GPL.
Maybe the fact that the hardware has the driver embedded in
it. You know, it would have to. You couldn't use a software driver on a router like you could on a Windows PC. Here, this is to show you some screens that just give you some insight into the system. Basically, what this is the output of an LS mod. So it's got USB modules loaded. It's got a ton of IP tables modules loaded. Some PPP modules. It's even got a printer module loaded. I'm not quite sure why you want to print from your router, but maybe you can.
Maybe share a printer. Hang right on your local USB port.
That's actually
print on your local USB port.
That's true, and turn your USB your router into a print server. Some system status gives you some RAM usage. Total is 32 meg, roughly. Then it has a couple of mega swap. It's tracking connections that are going through the router. Some disk space. Uses a temp partition. Also uses a JFFS partition. JFFS stands for Journaling Flash File System. It is a file system specifically for use on flash storage. And this is what most of the Linux distributions are using for user-writable space on that flash memory. What they will do for their root partition is they'll actually use a thing called SquashFS, which is a compressed read-only file system, which they can get away with because most of the important configuration stuff is actually written to NVRAM. And then you can see here somebody hung a USB key or something off of the device. We've got a mount disk 0_1. Not quite sure how that is. That might be a 80 gig external hard drive. Basically, the output of PS. A lot of things you'd expect to see, the various kernel processes, some BusyBox, something's writing the logs, they've got a logger process, syslog is running. One here that's interesting is NAS, N-A-S. That is the binary that is responsible for handling WPA. You need NAS running for WPA, you can mostly set that up through the GUI. I do remember at least a year or two ago, OpenWRT, you had to download and install a separate NAS binary to make this work. DDWRT, which is the most recent one that I've used, NAS is already part of it. DropBear is a very stripped-down, minimal SSH server. You've got a web server running. I'm not quite sure what web server it is, but there's a process called HTTPD, presumably listening on port 80-P80. You've got cron running. There is a DNS masquerade process that kind of acts as a mini DNS server for systems on your network. NTP. They're actually running VSFTPD on here, too. If you want your Linux router to be an FTP server, there you go. There is a easy IP update, which is a essentially like a dynamic DNS client. If you want to use DynDNS to keep your DNS records even straight, even though you've got a dynamic IP address, that's a service to use. Seen that already. Lee, here's your backup and restore configuration. So it, basically what this does is it creates a dump of all the NVRAM settings.
I'm trying to back it up the flash.
Well, here's your backup, here's your restore. So basically, to restore, you just upload the image that you downloaded.
But that's NVRAM, you said. I'm talking about flash.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're looking for something like Amanda or whatever on your...
Yeah. I should say, to save the flash before you upgrade. Yeah,
that's what you would do, is you just create a backup image.
It's right there.
Yeah, it says create backup.
Oh, backup flash partition, there you go, okay,
but this after you've already
installed. That's after you upgrade.
Mm-hmm. The idea is that, I don't want
you can actually download the original vendor firmware from the Linksys site, too.
Oh, that's true.
Another option for boot weight. Erase JFFS2 partition. Remember, that's where things that have to be written or stored. So if you've done an iPackage install, nmap, or TCP dump, or whatever, that's going to get written to that JFFS2 partition. So if you erase that, you're going to lose a lot of applications. And it looks like they managed to have one button in Polish and another one in English. I'm not quite sure how they did that. This is what an NVRAM looks like. All sorts of variables, most of which I don't have a clue what they do. Cron enable, obviously what it is. DDNS, dynamic DNS enable. Hostname, all you've got are key value pairs stored in NVRAM. Web interface for package management. Network settings, interfaces, IP addresses, DNS servers, LAN, WLAN. One thing that these distributions do by default is they will actually bridge your wireless LAN interface and one of the ports on your Ethernet, out of your four Ethernet switches, so that both of those are going to have the same IP. So that's how your wireless LAN clients are actually able to get through the router into the rest of your network. Host file, if you want to set IP addresses matched to MAC addresses for DHCP, wireless LAN, Well, do you want to have your IP address be your, or do you want to have a DHCP, NetMasks, set up OpenDNS?
Is that Jeff?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to update the DNS for you and problems come along?
DDWRT, I know, has. I think OpenWRT probably has too. Although I haven't specifically seen that, I haven't looked for it.
They're current enough that they'll probably do it if they haven't already.
Yeah, yeah. And it, as I said, I know DDWRT has fixed it because I saw that when I was putting slides together for this.
Okay, and just going over more detail on that, and I don't know if you know the answer, anybody else knows the answer. I understand this cache poison. that is something that's particularly nasty for a large DNS server, correct? On a small household server for your internal network, you're probably going to see that being a problem.
Well, not necessarily. The you know who H.D. Moore is, the guy that runs the Metasploit project?
Yeah.
He showed up at work one day and found out that his ISP's name servers had been taken over by this. So everybody in his office all of a sudden couldn't get to the Google they thought they were going to.
Yeah, then that's true. I mean, that's for their own. He was using his ISP servers as DNS.
Right, but if you're running your own name servers, is somebody going to deliberately target your name server?
Probably not.
Maybe, maybe not. Somebody could just be port scanning, looking for vulnerable servers.
As long
servers.
As none of your upstream DNS servers, your DNS server is clear.
Right.
But those aren't in your administrative control, so they're kind of funny.
OpenDNS has already patched theirs. There's lots of people recommending use OpenDNS if you get questions.
Part of the reason is the guy that owns that company is friends with the guy that's
always.
Are you, in the previous screen there was an OpenDNS section. Are you familiar with the options that are there?
I've actually never done anything with OpenDNS besides putting them in my resolve.conf manually.
I had neither, and then I stumbled across something last week that said that you could go on OpenDNS and sign up and say, I want to be this kind of customer. In other words, if you didn't want your kids surfing porn,
right,
you could tell OpenDNS, don't send me that stuff.
Hmm.
It looks like the only thing you have to do is update it. If you have a dynamic IP for your ISP, you got to tell OpenDNS what your IP address is when it changes.
Hmm.
Not unlike dynamic DNS. I was wondering if that's what that more...
I couldn't tell you. I've...
But it is a paper experience.
I know Dresty uses OpenDNS to perform away from the standard.
But is it based on using some product that's supposed to do it?
How do you do that? How do you get the blacklist?
What's that?
How do you get the blacklist of people, of what sites you want to block?
You hand off that task to OpenDNS. They do it. That's my, I don't know anything more about it. My impression is OpenDNS maintains the list. Your network uses OpenDNS for its name resolution.
It's sort of like if you're the bird company or here and the first site you go to, whatever you type in, you end up at their web page. It's the same, whatever you type in, and if it comes on the blacklist, they'll send you to their own page saying you can do it.
But if it's on my list of things to check out, it doesn't seem to cost anything, and you know, I've used OpenDNS before.
Yeah, you have to sign up and give them your IP address. To OpenDNS. I think you can turn off the domain not found thing too, can't you?
I think so. Hey, no, I'm sorry.
Okay. Wireless configuration, enable or disable your wireless interface. Do you want to broadcast your SSID or not? What channel do you want to use? What mode do you want to use? Access point, monitor client, whatever. Your wireless mode, B and G are supported, not sure about A. N, I'm not completely sure how much most of these distributions are going to support the wireless N capable routers. At least some of them will boot. Beyond that, it's kind of questionable. I expect that will get better as time goes on.
It's weird that some of these can have like a split wireless where you can have two different SSIDs.
There is
a lot like a public and a private network.
Yes, I have seen that. I remember seeing a couple of months ago that somebody had a distribution that would do that. It was not a major distribution. I've never seen anything more about it since.
You know what, the Fon, Fon, or Fonera, whatever, from Spain?
Well, oh, the...
That one you get to choose, I think. You can have both on there.
I was under the impression that it split, you get like a private wireless plus a public. So that way the public can not get into your private...
I think that might be what they're doing.
One of my problems is my TiVo only does WEP.
Well, that's good for at least 5 minutes.
Exactly. Which means that's all I can put on my router. I can't make my router any more secure and my whole wireless app.
Did you read an article about all of the confidential information that people are collecting about your viewing habits and selling and making money on it?
That was a big surprise.
Yeah, WP can be broken in seconds or minutes. WPA2 is not
too
broken.
So, anyway, your encryption settings, speaking of WPA, WEP, various algorithms, your key, and whether you've got your NAS package installed. Here's the bridging that we are talking about. Gives you some network utility, there's a ping, and we'll show you a little bit of what DDWRT looks like. This is a login prompt into actually my router at home running DDWRT, which really needs to be updated. The output of CPU info, Broadcom BCM 4712, 215 BOGO MIPS. That actually tell you what
MIPS?
What's that?
Bogus MIPS.
Yep. Proc mem info. There's my 4 mega RAM. Output of PS doesn't look a whole lot different than what we saw on the other one. Just in a terminal window. Bridging shows that we've got two interfaces, VLAN 0, which is an alias for one of the switch ports, and ETH1 bridged into BR0, and then I guess config for both of those. DF-H, there's the slash JFFS file system, and the read-only dev root, which is squash FS. Should have showed the output amount on there too. There's the web interface. This looks a whole lot like Linksys firmware. Router information, services enabled or disabled, including things like Radius, Samba, Sputnik, which is a hotspot, the DHCP server. Gives memory information, whether or not the radio is turned on or off, what mode it's on, packet information. Kind of like this, you can view the clients that are connected and what their signal strength is. More network configurations. Same stuff, different layout. Wireless mode, access point, network ABG, ESS ID, what channel are we broadcasting? Have this drop down so you can do the AP or client or bridging or ad hoc. Different authentication mechanisms, or your encryption mechanisms rather. A lot of things in the advanced wireless I'm not going to complain to understand. The beacon interval, how often in milliseconds that you're router goes out and beacons, fragmentation, ready to send threshold, some antenna configuration things, security and firewall enabled, disabled, lets you install a filtering proxy if you want to filter cookies or Java or ActiveX. It's kind of a cool feature. different things you can do, filtering things that come in on the WAN interface. VPN settings, IPsec, point-to-point tunneling, layer 2 tunneling protocol. Some internet access restrictions. This is kind of cool if you were doing this in any kind of a business environment. What days do I want to allow access to where? What time of the day? Do I want to block P2P? Are there any particular application protocols I want to block? Some applications, things like port forwarding, port range forwarding. Here's a screen where you monitor, where you manage the username and password on the router. Then you've got option to turn the GUI on or off, make it use HTTPS, what port are you running on. Boot weight again, cron. The hotspot menu, whether you've got stuff turned on or not. I saw no reason to turn on a hotspot in my own house. What services do you want to run? Various point-to-point tunneling protocols, DNS masquerade, DHCP. It's another opportunity to run some commands in a window inside a browser. Slightly more readable statistics page. Some information about the local area network, MAC addresses, IP addresses. Seeing all that in different screens. You notice they're showing you the same thing in different places. Wireless status. And then some good websites to go to for further information. DDWRT, OpenWRT. Wikipedia has a real good page on Linksys routers. I'll give credits here, the wiki.xwrt.org, which is where the extended web GUI came from. And that just about does it. Any questions?
You're early.
I'm early.
We've got a second one to go.
We've got another one to go.
Yeah.
What is there anything specifically that you use this OpenWRT software for that the stock links is doing for that you particularly happy with? It's just the factor.
I like being able to actually log into there, and if something isn't working correctly, I can do a TCP dump and see exactly what's coming across the interfaces. It makes it much easier to troubleshoot that way.
It also gives you features you wouldn't have on a channel like on a hotspot.
No, I understood that. I'm just curious specifically if there was anything that, like, oh, I set up an access point for the neighborhood. I did this filter.
I think these are actually more stable than the firmware you did with most of them too. Like my old Linksys version 1 had stability issues, and I'm thinking about putting this on and see if it fixes it.
I have never had a problem with this crashing. Not once. Actually, either OpenWRT or DDWRT.
It doesn't crash so much as
just flakes out. Yeah. The one thing I will say that I noticed is if I try to VPN into work through the wireless connection. OpenWRT seemed to have a little bit of problem dealing with that. It liked the hardwired connection much better. But other than that,
and while they're switching over, the name of that. I told you the three ways to get IP information. Yeah. The third one is called Resolve IP. Resolve IP, one word. Yeah. And the nice thing about that is you can do a dash S to use it in the script. So if you want to resolve a particular
whatever came
name, you get that address every time in the script. You don't have to go through a bunch of wrangling to get that IP address because that's all it is. If that's all it outputs, or if you want to get a particular IP address, what it's currently resolving to, it just gives you just the host name it resolves to. So it's great for scripting. Okay, next we're going to have Jeff.
I need a mirror.
Yeah. Let's see here.
Just want to get my bearings here.
Okay.
Well. Okay. Well, this will be interesting. I'll do the best I can. Is there a view one at a time? There we go. Okay. I really enjoyed that presentation because so much of what Jeff just talked about, I was kind of struggling whether to cover or not. So in the interest of time for mine, I decided not to do it. So cool. This is really a nice dovetail. My presentation I call The Taming of the Slug, and I brought this, and I didn't think I was going to be able to get it to work until I was driving here and I realized it was going to be okay. So what I'm talking about is this little goober right here, okay? I've got an external hard drive cabled by a USB to this little tiny box. And so I'm going to tell you the story of how I ended up getting... Actually, I have two of those things. But I'll tell you this...
The first guy tells what that black thing was on.
What's that?
On the cable.
Oh, just a... Velcro. That's a secret high-gain antenna.
attaches anyway.
Yeah, so let's see. I'm guessing left there. Cool. Okay, so... How did I end up standing in front of you today? Several years ago, I came across a device called the Cobalt Cube. I worked for Sun, and many moons ago, Sun purchased this company called Cobalt that made an appliance, an office appliance, small office appliance. It ran Linux. It was designed so that you didn't have to be a Linux guru. You just put it on your network. There's a little display on the back, you set the IP address, you go in through the web and you do configuration, and it could be your mail server, your web server, and your file server. You know.
It needs more space than file server.
Well, it's got a hard drive built into it.
I know,
yeah, this thing was pretty reasonable size. And so what that did was it spoiled me. Because once you have a place in your network in your house to dump stuff, it makes it a lot easier to shuffle things around. This computer, back up the laptop, back up this. You just start using this as a dumping file store. Well, that was great until the hard drive in that thing died. And that's when I said, well, it's time to do something to replace it. And I had an old PC lying around, which I pressed into service. Again, put Linux on it, you know, installed packages to do this and that. And it became the replacement for this. Took up a lot more space, generated a little bit more heat, made a lot more noise. But it was kind of the brick that was sitting around in the basement. Then I read about this device called the NSLU2, again from Linksys. And what this device is basically a little tiny board, right? Two USB ports, and that's it. And what it does as an appliance is let you attach external storage to it, you know, from the factory, and then with a web interface, configure it, and it becomes a network-attached storage device, and it only speaks SIFS. But people that run Windows, that's what they think a file server is, right? So I pondered buying one of those for a while, and I finally got to the point where I said, you know, I'm curious, what the heck? So I gave it a shot, I bought one of them, and stuck it in my basement, and let it be the file server, and over time it replaced that bigger PC. Then I started reading about people that were doing modifications to it and downloading some additional software. I'm getting ahead of myself. So the Slug is tiny, right? It's web-based server admin by default. You've already kind of seen what some of the interface is from the WRT. It has two USB ports and one 10100 Ethernet port. No internal storage, aside from the, you know, the flash memory and VRAM. As I was working on this presentation, I discovered to my horror that this thing has been recently discontinued. But doesn't mean you can't get your hands on it. All right. So if you're at all interested in this, in fact, I was at this meeting last month, or a Linux meeting a couple months ago. I mentioned in passing the Slug, and a guy leaned over and he goes, "I just bought one. Found one in a thrift shop. Shipped a thrift shop. Paid five bucks for it. I could have killed him." I told them, I didn't do that though. I said, if you find another one, grab it for me. So it's based on, you know, free and open source software. It's based on Linux and the GPL firmware. Now you can go to Linksys's website and download all the firmware. They kind of pass through that, running afoul of the GPL. So that's what some smart people did, and that spawned a large number of projects for replacing the firmware in the slug with different variants of Linux. There's a great quote here from the director of marketing for Linksys. While Linksys doesn't support any of the alternate firmware, we're always delighted to see a product gain such widespread acceptance. Well, yeah, it's because we based it on open source software that people could do cool things with. So this is another one of those Linksys products that's, you know, kind of got a second life with people doing fun things with it. So if you're at all interested in this, that's one of the websites that you should be familiar with. If you just Google for Slug, or Slug and Linux, you'll get right to this page. Down here, there are links to all the other different sub-projects. There's not one, just like we heard about DDWRT and OpenWRT, there's several of these projects for the Slug. The four main ones are Unslung, SlugOS, Debian Slug, which is a relative newcomer, and OpenWRT. So you can actually run OpenWRT on that device, if you'd like to, right? There's a lot of pros and cons. You know, the Unslung assumes that the person that's going to do this isn't a command line person, likes the web interface of the Linksys. They just want to have a way to scoot additional projects into their Slug. So that was somewhat attractive to me, except I knew I was going to want to do more. And as it turns out, after reading all these web pages, I decided that Debian Slug release is the one I was going to use. So this is the main site for one of the guys that does work on this project and has really nice documentation. So serious.com/debian-slu2. And the project is now named slugos/le. So again, how do you get started? You download a binary file and either TFTP it to your Slug or use the Linksys stock firmware, the web interface, to push this new image into it. What you're doing is you're installing, in this case, kind of a bootstrap loader that when you restart your Slug will be running an SSH server with the Debian installer. And at that point, you say, I want to load this, this, and this, and I'm sorry, you log in with this installer and that, you know, the IP address. And that's one of the other kind of weird things. The reason I didn't know if I was going to get this to work, now that's trivia, I don't have to dwell on that. But the bottom line is, once you get started, it looks very much like a Debian installation you've seen before. So that's how you do the software, at least to get it started. There's a lot of hardware mods that people do to this too, and a stock Slug runs at 133 megahertz. You can double the clock speed to 266 by removing that surface mount resistor. Now, I don't know if you have any sense of scale in what we're looking at, but that's really small. But I soldered really small components with one of my other hobbies, ham radio, and doing surface mount stuff. You don't have to use a soldering iron. Some people just take a fingernail clipper and just smash that resistor. But that offends my sensibilities because I always want to be able to put that part back if I ever need to. So I just unsolder and lift one up.
So do you run into any heat problems when you...
Obviously I was concerned. You know, you double the clock speed, that sounds like it'd be kind of hairy. It turns out, though, that hundreds of people have done this before. Nobody's had any problems with it. So I have two. Remember I told you I had two, right? So I was a little bit nervous about doing this, and I didn't want to mess with the one that I had that was providing this core feature of my house. So I bought a second one, and I figured I could hack away with it, and we'll see how it works. So it turned out that it worked fine. At this point, then, what I had, and I'm kind of getting a little ahead of myself, I'll show you some of the logs later to show you what I installed, but I was using this just as a file server, just a place to dump files in my house. It was very shortly after that I said, you know, this would be a great place to put all of my MP3 files so that I can listen to them when I'm here or when I'm there. So it became an archive for my music. So up to this point, I'm pretty happy with it, but there's good news, bad news with using a NAS file store for lots of songs. Namely, if you're using the music player here and the library software here, but you're files are over there, you have to catalog potentially a large number of files over the network connection. Right? They're not local. You've got the thing doing the library here, but the files over there. A lot of network traffic, and it turns out it's kind of slow. How do you solve that problem? Let that device be the librarian and tell you what it's got, rather than have to build all the stuff up, right? It's the classic server function. So the alternative was to add some stuff to my just-a-file server. And the icing on the cake is when I found this product called the Roku SoundBridge. This is the best money I've ever spent on technology. Because what it does is, and I should have brought this thing, I'm sorry that I forgot it, it's this big. Okay, it has almost no ports on the back, has a little remote control. You plug it into the power, you plug it into your stereo, and now it opens up the world of internet radio and playing over the network of your local files in your house. And it has a wired Ethernet port and also has wireless built into it with WPA support. So it's total nirvana. When I want to listen to music, I don't want to boot the computer, I just want to go up to the remote control and say, I want to listen to Jimmy Buffett. That's what this thing does. But it can play, in addition to internet radio, stuff that lives on your network. And so now, I'm compelled to make some changes to my slug. So it turns out that what it does is it speaks Apple's DAP protocol. Sorry, I don't remember what the acronym stands for. Digital Apple Audio Protocol or something, I don't know. And this is implemented in iTunes. Okay, let's do confession time. How many people have downloaded and used a copy of iTunes before? Anybody? Two? Three? Only three? Okay, it's all right. Those of you that haven't, though, are benefactors of this. Because what this does is it implements a client-server way to communicate players of music, servers of music. All right, and it's been... And it's a de facto standard by virtue of the fact that millions of people do this all the time to keep their iPods happy. And it's prone to reverse engineering. So, turns out that if you go to Wikipedia, for example, and look for software using digital audio access protocol, you'll see a number of projects, and I bet you may have run Rhythmbox before, right? Or Banshee, or Amarok, right? These are all... we commonly think of these things as Linux applications, players, and servers of music that use Apple's DAP protocol. It's been reverse engineered. Okay? So I looked at this list of all this cool stuff. Here's the Roku SoundBridge, right? So there's a commercial product that uses it. And so what I ended up doing is this command on my slug. It's running Debian now, right? Comfortable stuff. App get install mtdap. Debian does the right thing, chunk, 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 and in no time at all, my little slug was not only a file server, but it was also a music server. And here is a view of the web-based administration that's built into that package, and since I have this thing here, I think I'll be able to do live demo. So I won't do all this, except I got to remember the number, port number. 36. And here is Rhythmbox running on Ubuntu Linux, right? And it's looking at my library of my songs, which resides on Debian Slug, which is that very device and hard disk right there. So I can get to the files using Samba if I wanted to for whatever reason, or FTP. Certainly that's how I load files onto that thing. But once the DAP server is running, it does all the indexing, and then iTunes could, or Rhythmbox could, or any of these other applications, or my SoundBridge upstairs, can all talk to multiple devices that are sharing music around the house. So as a result, bought a small hardware box, put some Debian admin tools on it. Now I've got, like I said, a file server, DAP server. Could be running other things on this as well. Mini DNS server, I don't know what other kind of little function utilities you want to use dynamic DNS updater. You could run that on here. It's a perfect candidate for those little lightweight jobs. I don't, just because this is all that I use this thing for. It's nearly silent. The only sound it makes is the spinning of the hard drive, It's very small, obviously. Reliability means that this thing never goes down. If there's a power failure, this is not plugged into a UPS at home. So I have to go down and poke the button to reboot it. Haven't never lost any files, which is cool. And obviously, it uses significantly less power. So how green are you? So I knew I was going to talk about power when I came in front of you, and I always knew that there was going to be some sort of payback here, right? So let's find out. How many people are aware of when you buy electricity for Ameren, you buy it two different tiers, right? One time of the year, June through September, when it's hot and your air conditioner's running, 7.92 cents per kilowatt hour. But then you get a little bit of a break in the off season. The first 750 kilowatt hours you purchase are 5.62 cents, and then the rest 3.78 cents per hour. So today I was looking at the spreadsheet trying to think about what percentage of the power this is using in the off time and trying to calculate. So I just kind of did a swag. So the number in between here and here, I think I used this number to calculate my energy usage. And I measured the current draw of my PC, and I measured the current draw of that thing, that set of stuff. And it turns out, roughly estimating, it cost me $25.75 in electricity to run that PC for 1 year. It takes $8.39 to run the combo of the slug and the hard drive, saving me $17.35 a year. So it pays for itself in roughly 3 years. Right? ROI. And that's why when your wife says, well, what are you doing? I'm buying a slug. Don't you already have one? Now you've got the number. Okay? I just had to beg, but my wife, now I had to beg. She actually, yeah. So this, it was a lot of fun, obviously, too. So
you can't heat the house with it.
You can't heat the house with it. That is true.
You need a summer one and a winter one.
Yeah, that's it.
So last thing I want to say.
Put a resistor back in it.
Yeah, exactly. So I could. Yeah. So as I said, this has been discontinued. You can still find them. They're available on eBay. You can see the going rates about. I think you probably get one of these for about $50. I think. Let's see what buy now prices are. Yeah, $47.40, but they got the $14 shipping. So $60, $70 maybe. Or keep your eyes open at the thrift store. Definitely don't walk past one of these. If you ever find one, mm-hmm. and it's like $10, $20, just buy it.
So is
tell
like
me.
Replaced them or something? Or?
They were, the world of NAS servers has kind of exploded in that segment of the market. It looks like the manufacturers know that they need to put the storage in it. I think maybe having external storage kind of scared people off because it's too much of a science fair project for most people. So I think that's probably the case. I think that's it. So let's see here. I'm going to try showing you just a little of this. I don't know how successful I'll be creating my neck around.
Hooked up to the wrong thing?
Well, oh, yeah. Thank you. That would have been a bad demo. All right. Yep. Cable condoms can be fits here.
I have no clue what zero on that machine.
You want to?
Curiosity, has anyone built their own a mini server like with a mini ITX board? Anything like that? It's kind of the other alternative is to build your own low power board with
the top back compare with the energy consumption.
You want him to be one?
To the old cobalt.
Yeah, you want him to be, here's the router one.
Yeah, the slug is 78, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're good.
Thank you.
And.
By the way, everybody knows that the shortcut for getting there is Control L, right?
F6.
That's the, I use Control L because Control K, I just learned the other day, is how to get to the search field.
Control
L, 10. 4 F 60 seconds. Oh, God. I love these meetings. This is the best part of the night. 119, 168,
yeah. I was real disappointed when they changed Control O to Control L back in the Netscape, the Mozilla days.
Cool. NMT-DAP. ADMIN. I don't have caps lock on, do I? MT-D. Okay, all right. Cool. All right. Okay.
So, God's a smile on you.
So here's what you're seeing, and I got to be honest, I forgot that this thing even had a web interface. Because really, what once I set this up, I shoved it in the basement. I never touch it, except I have to power it on once in a while. So start and stop the server. How many songs? It hasn't indexed it, which is interesting. There's a little bit of configuration stuff. Oops, script forbidden. Jeff? Can I allow script global? Globally?
Yes. Go ahead. I'll change it back later.
we're attached to nothing here. I mean, this is the extent of my network, is this orange cable. So there's a couple little config things you can do here. There's a conf file that you can edit. But then there's also a feature of smart playlists. So, for example, you want to create a playlist where you say, all the songs by Jimmy Buffett, or all the songs that were from 1980 to 1989, or things like that. So you can build a playlist by teaching it the rule, and then it builds the playlist. And then when you go to attach to the server, you'll actually see that. So that's kind of what this is all about. And now, this will be the final question, is there a music player that will work?
Should be.
There's Rhythmbox. Whoops. There are some additional features of that DAP server. It can do transcoding. In other words, if your files are very high bit rate, but you want to deliver them at a lower bit rate because you're going over a thin pipe or something like that, it can do transcoding of the files on the fly. Come on, okay. So close.
That'd be good if you want to store all your files in FLAC and have iTunes reading as MP3s or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm, as long as it can read the file type. It's codec dependent. Yeah. Okay, so now.
What is it doing the transcoding? What product?
It's this server. I don't know what tools it uses. It depends on that music sharing is on. I expected this to show up over on the list on the left, and I haven't seen it yet. Ooh, stop.
I didn't tell it to go look for the server.
Yeah, it just does. No. I've never had to. In fact, I'm trying to recall. Terminal. Oh wait, there's a terminal running still here, isn't there? Wow. Yes, dear.
He lost the window.
Yep, and I'm logged into it now.
I mean, the music server.
Oh, yeah, it should be. Wow. The next time we do this, we got to arrange to have the laptop facing the screen.
Well, that's very easy to do.
How many wires we have to do here? In fact, let me just do a 45 degree. That might help.
Oh, Jeff, you put the chair
on. No, it's okay. I'm all right. It's my back is a deal. How do I get italics? Let's see. D message.
I'm never going to get my chair on the back.
I didn't change it. I'm looking for the BOGO MIPS line. Should be up here near the top. Yeah. Oh, there it is here. So 266 BOGO MIPS. So my box can beat up your box. But when I before I clipped the resistor, this was like 133 sub BOGO MIPS. So that's when you're done with the mod, that's how that's the first thing you look for to see if it worked. So here's you know the file system, and it's interesting because the way this thing bootstraps is that there's a little piece in NVRAM or flash that kind of gets things going, but all the real Debian system is getting written to this external drive. Okay, so that's really where root exists once you're booted up. And so if we look at CD bar, so I've got my music files there. I'm doing this just to do like how long does it take? So it turns out that this thing's not super fast, but it's plenty fast enough for doing file sharing. That may have been a little bit of an aggressive task to give it.
So how much good does SE Linux do on one of these things?
What's that?
You've got SE Linux installed. Oh. I was curious how much good it actually
does. Now, in my house, it really doesn't matter a whole lot. But that was part of it. I didn't have to install this. Let me see. CD. And I haven't touched this in quite a while. So let's do more. No. I wasn't sure about that. So this is the log of the first installation. And you'll see the number of packages it installs is 84 packages, 117 megabytes of disk space. More than the memory this thing would hold, right? But that's where you, why you stash it off in the hard drive. Sorry. So let's go through this. And when we get to the end of that section, there were a couple of upgrades here that were done. Then from this point, what did I install after the fact? Well, first thing I did was installed NTP so the clock was right. Then I installed the mtdatd server with its dependencies, so I made it the music server. And then I said, I got to have a way to get files onto this thing over the network. So I installed vsftpd, right, a light files FTP server. And then I started going down the Samba path, so I installed SMB client, Samba, SMBFS, and that's really all I've ever done to this thing. How much memory does it have? 64? And there are people that solder more memory into this thing. Is this thing, is this 32? It's 32 megs of memory.
Type free if you want to see the RAM.
Just free?
Free.
Well, yeah, 32 minus something. I'm just write that off the run here. But there are people that solder bigger memory chips on this thing, you know, trying to goose it. I was a little nervous about running the DAP server on here, whether it was going to start running out of memory. I haven't had a problem. So the question is, you know, what else could you run on this? I don't know. But if you, I've been talking about this as a file server or as a music server. But you can think about it as a server for whatever things you want to do with it. You know, there's a lot of packages in the Debian tree. And the Debian packages are okay, but they're not necessarily compiled to be really tiny. Some of those other distributions, the files are compiled to be much smaller, and that might suit your needs a little bit better. Yes, Dan?
The file storage, that's just an external USB box, whatever
right.
size you plug in.
Yeah.
So you can have it on there.
I just saw in one of the forums some disagreement about the maximum drive size that this, I think the stock ones can handle. And I think it has to do with whether you use one of these drives, it's actually two drives married together in the enclosure or not. But I did have people, then I remember saying 300 gig or 500 gig drives will work fine, so shouldn't be a problem. Certainly wouldn't be a problem if you're running Debian. If you use the stock firmware or one of these offshoots of the stock firmware, there are some limitations with the USB ports and what you can do with them.
No, is that external, just FAT32?
No, actually, it uses EXT3, I believe. EXT3. So you can pull that drive off and hook it up to another Linux box to put files on it if you want.
And when you're doing the installer, you can do your Debian packages on the EXT3 if you'd have to. But you could create another partition for whatever data that would be VFAT that would show up anyplace else, right?
Yeah.
Actually, if you're running Samba, you don't need to.
But if you, for some reason, wanted to disconnect this from the slug and put it into a Windows box, at least that way your data would be visible.
Hmm. Who's going to hook it up to a Windows box?
Yeah.
I'm normally the person that says that and gets slapped by you guys.
Well, if you want to share all your experience with your buddies.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and then there's other things too. There's other, music servers that are designed to do stuff over the network. I did that for a while, sharing files out from home. What was the name of that project?
Apache will do that.
Yeah, that's one of them. So, the sky's the limit. The point of this really wasn't to kind of get you excited about music necessarily, except, and I'm sorry, this didn't work. I don't know why. But, two things. Number one, that DAC protocol is really cool. It lets you do a lot of things from a music standpoint. That's one of the things that can do. But those things can do all sorts of different stuff. So if you ever think about, boy, I wish I had a little server just to do a couple of functions, didn't take up a lot of space, didn't make a lot of noise, didn't generate a lot of heat, and you have a bent of trying something, whether it be routing, in Jeff's case, or just file servers, in my case. It's a lot of fun.
File backup server? Whatever.
Sure. And one of my to-dos is to do something with rsync on that to push the file somewhere else. Or to do rsync actually to, if I put files here, I want them to end up over there type of a thing. So, haven't thought it all through. That's all I had. I appreciate it. I'm glad things kind of worked out. I'm sorry we've done this. Thank you for your help.
You're welcome.
What
we need.
Nope. Quit.
I got to turn the shutter down.